Hello and welcome to the TalkSpot. I'm Tim Scott.
I'm Peter Stockham.
And today we're talking about a very interesting topic that's been a growing conversation, not just in forensic toxicology, but in forensic science in general, and that's the issue of occupational exposure to traumatic evidence and the effects that can have on people who do the kind of work that we do. There's been a growing awareness of these issues, and some research has been developing in this space, including a recent paper by Samantha Shiro in the Journal of Forensic Sciences. She joins us today to discuss her research. Welcome, Samantha.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And the name of that paper in Journal of Forensic Sciences is Occupational Exposure to Traumatic Evidence and Post-Traumatic Stress Symptoms in Forensic Science Professionals, Prevalence and Patterns. So, Samantha, you're not a forensic scientist. Tell us about your background.
So I am not a forensic scientist. I am a clinical psychologist by trade. I have a doctoral degree from the University of Indianapolis, a doctor of psychology degree, so a PsyD, not a PhD. But some of my background is I grew up in Louisiana. My father, though, he was a forensic scientist, did crime scene work when I was younger, moved more to the lab setting as I got older, and was primarily working in the crime lab, and he now owns his own DNA testing lab. So while I am not a forensic scientist, I did grow up in that community and did spend a lot of time interacting with others in that capacity as well.
So that's how you got interested in doing this subject, I guess, as part of your thesis that you did for your psychology training.
Yeah. So my dad, he had a friend who had written a book, and I guess the book was talking more so about his experience. He was a death investigator and just the effects it had on him. And based off of that, I guess, reading, I kind of came up with the idea, and I brought it up to my advisor that this is a population that there may be some more trauma that's not really talked about. And I do think it's an important area to look into, as it is a profession, you know, that a lot of people are in, but we don't really hear about that side of it.
That's a really important part, because that's exactly what happens. A lot of people just don't talk about it. So getting this paper published and talking about it is a really important step, we think.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe can we define some of the terms that you use in this paper? Because one thing that we've talked a lot about just in our workplace and sort of in the conversation generally is this term vicarious trauma, but we're not psychologists. We're just using this term very loosely. We don't really have a technical definition of what this means, but you use terms in the paper like secondary traumatic stress, post-traumatic stress. Can you define some of these terms and maybe what the similarities or differences are between them?
Yeah, so with vicarious trauma as well as secondary traumatic stress, those are kind of used interchangeably. And what they both refer to is exposure to trauma, either through work or through interacting with individuals who have experienced a traumatic event, which can be anything from like natural disaster, sexual assault, watching another person die, whatever it may be. And for a really long time, that wasn't something that was included in the diagnostic criteria for PTSD, whereas witnessing, experiencing, or hearing about death, violence, and sexual assault were kind of more so included in the diagnostic criteria for PTSD. And then in 2013, the DSM finally decided to include this idea of vicarious trauma or secondary traumatic stress as one of the criterion A parts of the diagnosis. So now we're seeing more so people within professions that are kind of exposed continuously to traumatic stories or just continuously being exposed to traumatic events being more included in this diagnostic criteria.
So maybe this is a good point to explain to us as forensic scientists, how does a psychologist diagnose mental illness in general? You mentioned the DSM. You mind telling us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the DSM is kind of the manual we use when deciding to make a diagnosis for someone, as it goes through all the different types of mental disorders that someone can fall into. Typically for PTSD, there are certain criteria that needs to be met. So I mentioned the criterion A, and this is some type of exposure to a traumatic incident. Criterion B is experiencing intrusive memories, and this can include flashbacks, nightmares, and just like any type of thoughts that can pop into the head just like automatically without any conscious effort. So intruding on the thoughts. The next part is avoidance, and avoidance can be just avoidance of the thoughts, avoidance of emotions that are associated with the thoughts or the traumatic event, avoidance of external reminders, just anything related to the event that tends to be avoided due to the emotional response that it tends to elicit. Changes in cognition and mood. So this is maybe more difficulty experiencing positive emotions, maybe some self-blame, guilt, feeling just really strong negative emotions more so than you may have in the past. And changes in thoughts about yourself, about the world, or about other people. It doesn't have to be all three of those things, but maybe one or two changes in those thoughts. And then changes in reactivity. So this is being more on guard, more hypervigilant, difficulty with sleep, difficulty with concentration. So those are kind of the things we look for when making a diagnosis of, is this trauma or is this something else? And a lot of times with most diagnoses, we also want to see if there is any change in occupational functioning or social functioning. So are these different symptoms? Are they causing difficulty at work? Are they causing difficulty with relationships they're having? So usually it's that with the impact on functioning that will give a diagnosis of PTSD versus a diagnosis of something like other specified trauma or stressor-related disorder, which means they do meet the symptoms for what we would consider PTSD, but it's not to the level where it's impacting their work or their relationships with others.
So you used in your paper, you talked about some checklists or self-diagnosis checklists. Do they come from the DSM specifically in order to diagnose people? So is it that methodical in mental health spheres?
So the questionnaires we used, I think the one we use most commonly when assessing patients is the PCL5, which is the PTSD checklist. So it kind of goes through those symptoms that I did list out and kind of seeing where the patient, whoever is answering it, where do they fall? So it uses a 0 to 4 scale, so not at all too extremely. And usually if they're at a 2 or above, that means they would meet criteria for that. And so again, the cutoff score for that would be a 31. So if they're below that, they may be experiencing these symptoms, not to an extreme level, but they're still present. But if it's higher than a 31, then they're obviously experiencing these symptoms at a greater level that would require further evaluation. So questioning those things specifically when we meet with them and trying to get an understanding of what's going on when they're mentioning those things.
So you mentioned at the beginning category A. Mm-hmm. And so without getting past category A in this PTSD diagnosis, you never used to be able to get diagnosed for PTSD if you had an occupation where you experienced this trauma. That seems a bit strange to me that you're obviously experiencing trauma and it's your job, but you can't get PTSD because it says so in this checklist or in this DSM manual. But then they changed it, thankfully.
Yes. So in that case, if the individual is experiencing all these other symptoms, but not necessarily meeting what used to be the criterion A trauma, they would still get maybe a diagnosis of other specified trauma or stressor-related disorder. So again, they're having all these symptoms, but it's not related to a specific traumatic event.
And obviously the first one of the first groups of people that came under this umbrella were first responders, right? Because they experienced traumatic situations daily. So
right. Yep. Yeah, first responders. And one of the things when I was doing the literature review for the paper was looking at studies with first responders and kind of seeing that, well, they're experiencing, you know, higher levels of post-traumatic stress symptoms. So who's to say that others in similar professions aren't going to be experiencing that as well?
So that brings us to your specific study, which was on forensic scientists. So tell us, what were your aims in this particular study?
I think the main kind of goal with this was just to see, like, is this a problem within that community, or is this something that needs more focus? When I was doing the research for it, I could not find, like, any papers specifically on forensic scientists and PTSD. So obviously, in looking at all that, I was like, well, this is definitely something that should be looked at more and definitely something that should be studied more. And then, like I said, with my dad, his friend who wrote the book, seeing that this is obviously something that people are experiencing, why isn't it something that's talked about or studied more often?
Tell us about your methodology then here. This was obviously talking with forensic science professionals.
Yeah, so basically, as far as the methodology goes, we created a survey using different measures that look at PTSD. So the life events checklist was one, and that just kind of goes through different traumatic events and whether that person has experienced it, witnessed it, know a close friend or family who had experienced it, or was exposed to it through work. So people will go through and kind of check off what their experiences are with the various traumatic events. And it goes through different things such as natural disaster, exposure to things within the work environment, combat, sexual assault, those kinds of things. And if it's applicable, they can check off. And there's also a not applicable section that they can check off too if it doesn't relate to them. So that was the first one. And then the second one, as I mentioned, was the PCL, the PTSD checklist. And that, again, kind of goes through the different symptoms that we typically see with post-trauma responses and allowing the individual to answer on that 0 to 4 scale how much they're experiencing those symptoms currently within the past month we were looking at.
Yeah, you had a lot of respondents, 449.
Yes.
forensic science professionals, including toxicologists.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think the similarities are between first responders like paramedics, police officers? What are the similarities that forensic scientists have in their occupations with those fields?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the study, one thing we were looking at was field-based respondents and non-field-based respondents. So field-based respondents being more those people who actually, like, go out to the crime scenes or work with, like, the evidence that is collected or the ones collecting evidence. And then the non-field-based ones are the ones who are more in the lab. But I was kind of aware that, you know, even when you're in the lab, you're still being exposed to various traumatic material. You're seeing crime scene photos. You're handling evidence. You're still handling, like, human remains, those kinds of things as they come into the lab. So I do think, as far as, like, similarities go, these individuals are still seeing, like, traumatic evidence or traumatic stimuli that can impact them in the future, just like first responders who, not always working with victims, but they're still working those scenes. They're still having to go and, like, collect things from those scenes or see things that, while it may not be like a body or something, they're still having to see things that not everyone is exposed to on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and then often some of those people who go out into the field will have to come back and spend hours and hours working on those samples again. So I can imagine how it would amplify any effects that you have.
Yeah.
And when you talk about people in the laboratory, that's often what forensic toxicologists do. They spend a lot of time in the lab, but we are often reading a lot of case files, a lot of case histories. We do get a lot of context-based information. So, yeah, this is very important.
Yeah.
So what differences did you find then between field-based versus non-field-based in this study?
Yeah, so I think the biggest difference we found was that field-based respondents did have a higher level of provisional PTSD diagnosis. So we couldn't obviously give them an official diagnosis, but provisionally they could possibly have that diagnosis. Compared to the non-field-based respondents, there was only, I think, a little over 14% that met the provisional diagnosis criteria. So while there might be a higher level in field-based respondents, I think it's also important to note that even the non-field-based respondents, it's still higher than what the prevalence is within the general population alone, much more elevated than what it is in the general population alone. So
what would it be in the general population?
General population, 12-month prevalence rate for post-traumatic stress is about 3.5%. So within a 12-year period, only about 3.5% of the U.S. population will meet criteria for PTSD diagnosis.
Right. So, yeah, both groups are significantly higher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you mentioned 8 to 9 times higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what else did you find in your results that was surprising maybe to you?
I think one of the things, and I know it's mentioned in the paper, is just the amount of traumatic events that the respondents were indicating they had experienced, more so in relation to work. So I think it was like about 6.2 traumatic events occurring on average for the respondents, which is high in comparison to what I think you would see in the general population. I guess taking out like first responders, taking out military individuals. But just, you know, 6.2 traumatic events in a lifetime is a lot for, I think, anyone. So that was another thing that I just found to be interesting.
So in your life, I guess you, if you experience these traumatic events, it can have an effect on the way that you have an outlook on the world. And what sort of ways does this trauma and secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, affect people?
Yeah, so I think the biggest one that we see, and actually one of the trauma therapies that we use does tend to focus more so on like changes in thoughts as a result of the trauma. So looking specifically at like how your thoughts change in relation to yourself. So that would be like maybe more guilt, more self-blame, that idea of like it's my fault that this happened, or it's my fault that I was there, those kinds of things, or changes in how you think about other people. So other people can't be trusted, other people are dangerous, and then changes in how you think about the world. So the world is a dangerous place, the world is unfair, is something we see really commonly in people who have experienced trauma. And I think specifically with this profession, it's probably more so related to those thoughts of people being dangerous or the world being unsafe in some kind of way, because day to day you're seeing horrific things that people can do, and that can take a toll on anyone.
Yeah, I guess forensic scientists are at that sort of in that realm, aren't we?
Yeah, if you've worked on a lot of cases, for example, that sexual assault cases, I guess you might have some more fear of going out, you know, at nighttime, or of being in particular places, or just more suspicion of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And also, because we deal with a lot with drugs and driver cases, a lot of road accidents. And from our perspective, it looks like that everyone who drives a car is on drugs. And so people say that they never engage in any sort of altercations. They just say, okay, you can cut me off, that's fine, I'll leave you alone, because you never know whether they might be on methamphetamine or something that might just trigger an incident. So that's sort of on the lower end of the scale, but yeah.
Well, that's something that's interesting, Pete. So, Samantha, how do you draw that line between, you know, all our experiences in life change our outlook on life, and some of these things, like avoiding, you know, an erratic driver is probably a sensible thing to do for anyone. So how do you define where that line is, where it actually crosses over into being a traumatic effect on someone?
Well, one of the things that we often ask about too when doing the PCL is like engagement in risky behaviors. So something that you may see is like someone, I guess like an example I see a lot is like driving over the speed, like 15 miles per hour over the speed limit. So again, I think it goes back to that idea of how much is it impacting their functioning day to day? Like, are they drinking more? Are they using substances? Because that is, used as a coping mechanism to help them forget or to avoid feeling the emotions, to avoid thinking about, just to avoid thinking about what happened, or again, kind of a way to avoid those thoughts of it's my fault or all people are terrible, the world is unsafe. So I think while that's not necessary for a diagnosis, I do think it is something that's important to take into consideration, because it's like, are they going to be a danger to themselves? Are they going to, is this something that could be a factor into more risky behaviors? So it's definitely something we do look at and continue to monitor as we work with patients who have trauma, and like, what are these behaviors that you are engaging in to help you forget?
So that's the problem, I suppose. But what's the solution here, Samantha? What are some of the things that can actually help people who are experiencing this, or maybe help people not to go too far down that path in the first place?
Right. So one thing that we did look at in the study, specifically for a protective factor, was social support. And I think that's really important when thinking about trauma and recovery. So if you don't have like anyone who you can talk to, if you don't have anyone you trust well enough, then, you know, who are you talking to about these things? Who is providing that support for you? And when thinking about trauma treatment, that is something that's also really important, because with trauma treatment, what we're trying to do is get people to actually talk about what happened and talk about the effects that have. So what are those thoughts that are specifically going through your head? What are those emotions you're feeling? And allowing them to experience those emotions in session is one of the things we try to do with some of the treatments we use. So I think by having people you can talk to about it, by having people who you can express those emotions to, express those thoughts to, it goes a really long way in helping people overcome what's happened to them. Because another big part of the problem with trauma is that avoidance, in that, you know, you're not allowing yourself to actually think about what happened. You're not allowing yourself to experience those emotions. And it's mostly because those are uncomfortable emotions. Like, you don't want to feel angry, you don't want to feel guilty, you don't want to feel sad, but you also need to allow yourself to have that experience so it can help you process, you know, what happened. Even if it is uncomfortable for a while, we do know that emotions over time on their own do start to go down, and it does become something that's easier to manage over time.
So within the workplace, you're talking about having a social network. That's where the workplace really comes into it, isn't it? And you talked about trauma treatment, but that can actually start just with a conversation with workmates. Is that correct?
Yeah. And that's something too, I see like day to day with people I'm working with. It's like, oh, well, like so-and-so told me I should, you know, talk to someone. And usually it's a coworker that has suggested therapy because, you know, they've had similar experiences to one another. So of course they're going to be able to understand like, okay, I know what this person's going through and I know that therapy helped me. So therapy can help them, but what can I do like in the meantime while they're waiting to get that appointment, or if they're hesitant, like just talking to someone. I think even writing too can be helpful, just writing down like how you're feeling. And
I guess where I'm thinking is that, let's just take for example a mortuary technician who experiences effectively what would traumatize most people dozens of times a day. That's just their normal job. They're not going to go and have a therapy session about that every day. I think what people are encouraged to do in a lot of these jobs is to actually share it with their colleagues. And that's where a lot of team building and team atmosphere can actually help the overall team to cope with these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think just by having coworkers to talk to, I think that's also really helpful, because like I kind of mentioned before, they're going to be the people that understand best, you know, what you're dealing yeah. with and what you're going through. So they'd be the people you'd want to talk to, whether it's, you know, to get help or just, you know, to decompress, vent, whatever it may be.
And often, I guess, a family wouldn't want to, you don't want to burden your family with a lot of the things that first responders or people in our field see. Yeah, so talking with people who are in the field helps.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of forensic scientists might talk about compartmentalizing their work. You know, when people ask them, how do you deal with some of the things that you experience? And they'll talk about, well, I just leave it at work and then I come home and I deal with my family differently. I'm curious what a psychologist thinks about that idea of compartmentalizing things. Is that a good thing? Is that a healthy thing?
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. One thing I talk to pretty much everyone about is work-life balance and being able to balance your work and your personal life. And I think a big part of that goes back to leaving work at work, and not really something I focus on a lot in therapy, but something that I do talk about with my patients is like values and what are their values like outside of work. So like, do you value your family? Do you value being a good husband or wife? Do you value being a good parent? So how can you focus on those things when you're at home and work toward that goal without having, you know, like work come in and affect those relationships? So I think with compartmentalization, it's not a bad thing, but, you know, still kind of recognizing like this thing did happen, processing through that, and then kind of being like, okay, well, refocus, go home and work toward being with my family and being present. And that's another thing I talk a lot about with people who do have that trouble of kind of separating their work from their personal life is being more present focused and how to do that when they're at home with their families.
So one other thing you mentioned in the paper was some of the actions that can be taken by organizations who employ forensic scientists to deal with some of these things. That wasn't a main focus of your paper, but one interesting thing that you mentioned there was that some of the strategies that organizations take aren't necessarily very effective, or we don't know how effective they are. Can you talk a bit more about that and maybe what organizations can do?
Yeah, so I think one that we see a lot is like psychological debriefing. So this is something that's seen, I think, in both forensic science organizations. The military is another one that uses it, first responders as well, where they just kind of go and have the person talk about what happened, but don't really, you know, like go beyond that. So it can actually make trauma symptoms worse sometimes when that happens because they're not allowing them to process fully through what happened or allow for that processing of emotions. That's also really important. So while it may be helpful to get them talking about it, it's not helpful in the long run to just have that be the one thing that they, you know, do to prevent the possibility of an individual developing some type of trauma response. I think some things that could be more important or more helpful would be something like providing resources for where they can get help. And that doesn't necessarily have to be mental health. It could just be like a support group, some other individual they can talk to. Where I work, we have like lower levels of care that people can utilize. So life coaches, counselors, phone counseling, those kinds of things can also be really helpful. Just some way for them to talk about what happened more in depth. I think it's also important to educate people on what the signs or what the symptoms are of post-traumatic stress, because a lot of times people may be experiencing these things and just think it's normal. Like that's something everyone goes through. Like I've heard people tell me like, oh yeah, like I have trouble sleeping, but I thought that was normal. Or, you know, I just feel really anxious when, you know, I'm out in a large crowd. And I thought that was something everyone experienced. So, you know, kind of helping people to understand like this might be something that you are dealing with. And while it's not abnormal to have those experiences as a result of trauma, it may be beneficial to go get help before it gets to a point where it's worse. Because a lot of times, sometimes people don't even begin to experience symptoms until years later or are afraid to get help when it does get to that point. So I think normalizing their experiences, as well as kind of saying like getting help is a normal thing too. In the work that I've done in the past, whether it was through graduate school or currently, I like to talk to my supervisors a lot about if I am struggling with something or if I do have some patient that I'm working with and it's really hard interacting with them, or if something's coming up for me while I'm talking with them. So also having that support from supervisors and being able to talk to them as well can just be really helpful for people.
So this was part of your doctoral work, as you said. Are you planning any future research in this area? It seems like there's a lot of space to do more research on forensic scientists.
Yeah, I mean, that's the intention, to get more people to engage in this type of research. Specifically me, I don't know. I went into the field to be able to do clinical work, so I don't know if another research study is something I would want to undertake right now.
Fair enough. Maybe. Yeah, you've got a day job. That's understandable.
Yeah, maybe at some point in the future. I don't know. But I do think it's definitely an area that needs to be studied more. And I do hope that with this study, it does encourage more people to do more research into the field and the prevalence of trauma. I think looking at other disciplines, like the ones we didn't get maybe as much respondents in, can be something to look at in the future as well. But if anyone does want to undertake some more research, I'd look forward to reading it and help in any way I can.
I wonder, this was obviously done in the United States, which is where you're based, and we don't have a lot of studies like this, you know, from other places. But just in general, with the kind of studies like this on any kind of area of psychology, how well do they translate from one country to another country, or one culture to another culture? Are there a lot of similarities, or do you find big differences?
I think it depends, really, just thinking specifically about like the DSM. And one thing the DSM does list out is like prevalence rate in other countries for certain diagnoses. I can't remember specifically off the top of my head if it does that for PTSD or not, but for some diagnoses, there is a lower level that is seen in comparison to other countries and other cultures. But I really think it just depends on the diagnosis you're talking about, because sometimes diagnoses do have a more biological basis, biological or environmental. It just kind of depends. But I think specifically for trauma, it again is dependent on what resources are available. And specifically thinking about cultures, there are different cultures where mental health and seeking help is more stigmatized than others. So, you know, I imagine it can be the same for countries as well. If, you know, is seeking mental health more acceptable somewhere?
Yep. Or accessible. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of organizations do have employee assistance programs. So I guess you have similar organizations in the States as well. So they're always a good resource to go to first off.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about the category A, that's the first part where you qualify, where you might be considered to have PTSD. About 74% of forensic science practitioners have experienced a trauma event that would put them in that category. And so it's important to remember that forensic scientists will and probably do have a higher level of PTSD than the general population. So this is very important work. Thank you.
Yeah. Like I said, this was 4 years of my life. So, like I said, I'm happy that, you know, it's getting out there and getting some recognition. Cause like I said, I feel like growing up within the forensic science community, I do think it is something that's really important and something that more people need to be aware of.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, Samantha. This was a really fascinating conversation for us, something quite different to the subjects we normally talk about on this podcast, which are usually very technical, toxicology focused. But this has been a growing conversation and a growing body of research in this area. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here. And for our listeners, if you feel like maybe you are experiencing some of these things that Samantha's talked about, I encourage you to talk with your colleagues, talk with your organization, talk with a therapist, whatever you have access to in your area. So thanks for listening.
We'll see you next time.
Registration is now open for the 61st annual TAFT meeting taking place from the 2nd to the 6th of September 2024 in St. Gallen, Switzerland. The early bird rate is only available until May 31st, so be sure to register soon for the reduced rate at www.taft2024.org. We look forward to welcoming you to St. Gallen for an inspiring, engaging, and enlightening conference.